It's the weekly community radio program devoted to investigating the journalism and media industry at large. Thanks for tuning in to The Fourth Estate. My name is Meg Caldwell. Glad to have you with me as we now look ahead to what's on for today's show.
A lot of women working in production and in management in radio, they're just not on air in that particular genre of talkback radio, and it's a brutal world. If you don't rate, you're off.
Radio legends Angelica Turns and Julie McCrossan discuss women in broadcasting and shock jock schlock. Plus, does Cricket Australia have too much junk in the trunk when it comes to sponsorship deals? And we investigate whether rural and regional Australia is in fact ready for the national broadband network. So do stay with me for all these stories and more. It's The Fourth Estate. For a Western democratised society such as Australia, we have generally been considered far behind the likes of the US, the UK and New Zealand when it comes to legislation within the journalism profession. That is, until now. The Greens' shadow spokesperson for communications, Senator Scott Ludlam, has recently succeeded in passing through an amendment act ensuring journalists are able to promise the privilege of protecting confidential sources without facing legal repercussions. The Evidence Amendment Journalist Privilege Act 2010 has simply changed the definitions of the terms journalist and news medium. Stilgarian is a new media commentator. I spoke to him recently in the first part of a two-part series looking at one of the more exciting revelations in media law.
Originally, the new law was going to say that the journalist was essentially someone who worked as an employee doing news for a news outlet, and whether they were paid to do it was the real test. These amendments, which were put through by the Greens, change that, and the test now essentially is anyone who's active and engaged in the making of news. Now, that's important because if the law had made employment the test, the fact that they weren't paid meant that they wouldn't be covered by this shield law.
Does that in turn maybe detract from the idea of journalism as a profession?
Perhaps, and that's one argument, because, you know, here's the test. How do you say someone is a journalist as opposed to someone sticking something on the internet? You know, that profession of journalism carries with it that idea of an ethical approach, the journalist code of ethics and so on. So, you know, if someone is employed as a journalist or is a member of the MEAA, then they've subscribed to this professional relationship. And now the law is essentially saying that's not the key factor. The key factor is whether they're involved in the making of news, whether they subscribe to that particular style of ethics or not. Now, personally, I find this a bit, you know, it's an interesting debating point because although there is the MEAA Code of Ethics, that's not necessarily the only way of looking at how the media works. The differentiation I make between capital J journalism and, if you like, a journalism with a lowercase, that the style of journalism practiced in the media factories, if we can call it that, and practiced by members of the professional association, well, that is only one way of interpreting the day's events through the media. Personally, I think it's great that we're not limiting the rule to that, but to all the other kinds.
So basically, the amendment has taken the idea of news media and journalism and rearranged it to kind of make it fit. Do you think maybe then we need to readdress what the public interest might encapsulate?
It will be interesting to see how the courts interpret that, though, you know, public interest can mean a very great many things, and we've seen over the years. It's one of those things that has no, you know, strict definition, so it will be interesting to see how the courts interpret that, as I say. Even if a journalist is an employee of a major news organisation, and even if a journalist has supposedly signed up to the MEAA Code of Ethics, that doesn't mean they're necessarily actually going to follow those ethics. And I think there's a bit of a a difference between the kind of journalist who will stand up for their ethics, they will keep their confidences, and they are willing to go to jail. And then there are other people also working as journalists who work, say, for tabloid TV programs or some of the more nefarious media outlets. And even though they're ethically upheld to protect, you know, people's privacy and so on, that simply doesn't happen. And all of those people get to call themselves journalists. I mean, that brings us back to our earlier point about, you know, should that be the test of whether someone is a journalist or not? Well, even now, you know, in practical terms, it doesn't seem to make a lot of difference for some people who call themselves journalists.
Yeah, and I guess it's interesting because this is, I think, a debate that you might have, you know, previously touched on is, you know, are bloggers and journalists the same kind of person? I know there's been a lot of debate about the idea of one doing the other, and a journalist can't have a blog and a blogger can't be a journalist, but under this amendment, it's all pretty much the same, isn't it?
It is. I mean, it's not about whether the person is a blogger or is a journalist. The person can be both. They can be one. They can be neither. It's about what was the act, what was occurring. So journalism is presumably about a process. It's about an approach to how you do things, and that's one way of doing it. Blogging is another way of interpreting the world, and it's about producing a different kind of media output. And so, really, it's about the act rather than about the person. And this will be something, I think, too, that will come up, I'm sure, in the first kind of court cases that relate to that. You know, we talk about the journalist is involved in, what's the phrase here, engaged and active in the publication of news, and a news medium is about, disseminating to the public or a section of the public news and observations on news. So the arguments that will end up in the first court cases on this will be, well, what counts as news, and the kind of speeches against the law, particularly Senator Brandis, was earned about this definition of journalism, and it might, you know, apply to anyone.
What does this say now? I mean, we've been pretty behind the mark. Do you think this is the start of something great for the media in Australia?
I actually suspect that it's more that this is a kind of one-off law, and if we're trying to look for any coherent approach, you know, proper freedom of speech rights and so on, that'll be too hard a biscuit to bite for the legislature. It's going to be, I think, a slow, gradual push of little pieces like this, which might eventually add up to that big picture. But I honestly don't see the kind of politicians we have these days generally having a go at the big picture issues of freedom of speech.
Weighing up on the recent passing of an Amendment Act, that was new media guru and commentator Still Garian. And do stay tuned next week on the Fourth Estate for a chance to catch up with the whistleblowing side of it. Will it compel the public to reveal instances of corruption and in turn promote trust between the media and the public? Talkback Radio has a long-standing and successful history within the Australian broadcasting industry. What began as a medium for politicians to voice opinions and engage with the listeners, it's now one of the most successful programming divisions of its kind, and in turn attracts the biggest advertising revenue. Further studies have since found that the use of highly emotive language expressed within this format is what has led it to such prominence. Anna Marie Reyes recently celebrated the passing of International Women's Day by talking to two of the country's most prominent female broadcasters, Angela Caterns and Julie McCrossan, who reflect on their career and evaluate the position that women can have in a shock jock world.
The fundamental purpose of talkback in the commercial sector, as I understand it, is to have very cheap fill between the ads. Commercial radio's imperative is, of course, to make money, and that's done through the attraction of ads. They've discovered that what draws the most people to listen to the ads, and that therefore you can sell the ads for a higher price, is very strongly argued, highly opinionated points of view. It's ideal if those points of view are conservative points of view. They're high profile, these talkback people, but they're only a proportion. Now, do they have disproportionate influence on government? Yes, they do. Anyone who watches the sycophantic treatment of Alan Jones, the fear among lobbyists and government members around people like Alan Jones is palpable.
This is a Fox News alert. Top Australian cops reacting angrily to the mob violence in that country earlier today. Protests exploded into violence as some 5,000 surfers and locals gathered at a beach in Sydney.
Breakfast with Alan Jones on 2GB 873.
Commercial talkback. So in Sydney, we're talking about 2GB and 2UE. They are the talkback stations. Neither of them have a woman in any major on-air shift. You might find a woman comes on air as a gardening expert or perhaps an entertainment expert, or she might talk about the stars and astrology, but she won't occupy one of the primetime major shifts on air.
Angela Catern's there.
A lot of women working in production and in management in radio, they're just not on air in that particular genre of talkback radio, and it's a brutal world. If you don't rate, you're off. That's true for men as well as women. It's a very tough game, and maybe it's true that the sort of people who like black and white, conservative, strongly argued, unambiguous opinion as a stimulus to ringing in, because that's the little niche we're talking about. Maybe it's true that the listeners who like that style of radio prefer male voices. Maybe that's a commercial reality. Or it may be that there are fewer women who are comfortable and confident in communicating in that black and white, rigid, dominant style.
I was sacked from 2SM many years ago in the 80s. I was suddenly hauled up to the boss's office one day, and I was told that women don't like listening to other women on the radio, so we're going to have to let you go. That was quite a shock to me. So anyway, I don't think there exists any research to prove that theory, but it's a theory that blokes who run radio stations still subscribe to.
The so-called blokes that you're mentioning, let's concentrate on the shock jocks of Sydney, they're actually from a different generation now. A lot of us are into social media. We have Facebook accounts. We have Twitter. We get into different kind of radio. We use the internet. How relevant do you think talkback will be in the next few more years?
Well, they have an old audience, as I'm sure you know. The majority of Alan Jones's listeners, for instance, are 60-plus. So they'll be around, given that the, you know, life expectancy is growing, you know, they'll be around for another 20, 30 years. So I don't see it changing anywhere in the foreseeable future, because commercial radio is an extremely conservative business and it sticks to tried and true formats and tried and true formulas. And what's worked in the past will work for them again. And so that's why they never make any changes.
Tried and true formats. Do you mean the type of radio or type of talkback? Because, I mean, ABC radio has used it. The type of talkback that shouts at you, work on your fear, or highly opinionated talk. Is that what you're talking about, that type of talkback?
Yeah, so, absolutely.
So are you're almost implying here that there are actually listeners that like to be shouted at? And
well, my darling, Alan Jones is the highest rating radio announcer in Australia, certainly in Sydney. So go figure.
I'd like to ask you, if a young woman would ask you now, I want to break into the shock jock, you know, sector, what do I do? How do I survive? What are the survival strategies?
Well, you're not going to have a chance in 2GB or 2UE, I can tell you that now. It's dinosaur radio, and it will continue to be so for some time, honestly. They just are not going to change. It's so conservative and it's so hidebound and it's so stuck in the, well, this is what's worked in the past. We might tweak it a bit around the edges. But there's no way we're going to put a woman on the radio or two women on the radio at the same time. Wendy Harmer and I do what's become a fantastic double act, if I do say so myself, but it's very popular and it gets a lot of fantastic feedback. We started off doing podcasts together for the ABC, and now for 2 years in a row we've been asked to do the summer breakfast program. That's when the regular presenter goes away for 6 weeks or 8 weeks, so we come in and do our breakfast over the summer, and it's fantastic. It's really good fun. It gets a lot of listeners. They really enjoy it. And it's got great potential. We've both previously been number one in breakfast time. So you would think that that is, you know, kind of a gold-plated proposition here. But it's never going to happen. It's not going to happen on commercial radio. And even the ABC is loath to give us a you know, a permanent gig of any kind.
Was it hard for you?
Yes, it did. I was absolutely horrified. I was gutted. I didn't see it coming. And to be sacked for that reason. Women don't like listening to you. You know, well, how can you say that? Show me the piece of paper. Show me the evidence. Show me the research that you've done. But they can't. They don't. Then they never will. It's just this assumption that's made by men in commercial radio.
And how did you fight on?
I took some time off. I saved up money. I went to work overseas. I actually got a job in an American radio station, which was a something that I'd always wanted to do. And it was on the strength of the work that I'd done on 2SM.
Yeah.
They loved the sound of it.
Okay, so we shouldn't all lose hope.
No.
Women like me in this generation.
Beloved radio personality Angelica Turns ended that empowering International Women's Day special from Anna Marie Reyes on the For the State. It has arguably been one of the most contradictory sponsorship deals since cigarette advertising in sport. But KFC and Cricket Australia have enjoyed a long-lasting and prosperous relationship. Recently, former cricketer Stuart McGill said athletes should not accept money to promote unhealthy food brands, as there is much concern about the influence of advertising on young people. Kay Metta, nutritionist as well as an expert in advertising from Flinders University, says that the government needs to take responsibility by imposing restrictions on the marketing of unhealthy foods to children. She spoke to John Gibb.
Advertising works exactly as it is intended to, which is to persuade children to desire products. You know, companies wouldn't spend globally billions of dollars advertising to children if it didn't work. So it does. It's highly effective. There's mountains of research to prove that it's effective, and children desire products. Young children exert their purchasing power by pestering their parents, and the industry actually uses the term pester power. And then as children get older, they have access to their own money. And children are a huge market for a whole range of industries, particularly toys and food and leisure and entertainment.
Are parents more vulnerable to their children's demands when it's a sports person or celebrity backing the product?
All celebrities have got status within society, whether they are entertainment celebrities like children's entertainment celebrities like the Wiggles or sporting stars. They are called celebrities because they have, you know, a special status. People look up to them, they earn big incomes, and children in particular look up to celebrities. They are successful in whatever field they're in. If children are interested in sport, well, they would aspire to be like that sporting star. So they have, you know, quite a high persuasive pull on children, and for that reason, it's extremely dubious for them to be used to market products, particularly because most of the food that is marketed to children falls into the category of unhealthy foods, being too high in fat, salt, or sugar. And, you know, on the subject of celebrity endorsements, the Children's Television Standards, which is a legislated piece of law, if you like, actually prohibits the use of popular personalities to advertise products to children.
Former cricketer Stuart McGill said sports stars should not accept money to promote fast food brands like KFC and McDonald's. What do you think about athletes promoting these unhealthy eating habits?
Well, I think it's absolutely not okay for many reasons. You know, I talked about just the fact that they carry such persuasive power in the world of children or in the minds of children, but also it's extremely confusing for children to have sporting celebrities that they look up to and supposedly lead healthy lifestyles because they engage in sport, then promoting unhealthy products, you know, sends out confusing and double messages to children.
What are some of the effects of negative advertising on children?
As a nutritionist, the advertising of unhealthy foods has a direct influence on children's food preferences and their choices. So children actually desire unhealthy foods, and our national nutrition surveys show us that children are not eating enough healthy foods and are eating too much unhealthy foods. And one of the consequences is, you know, that childhood obesity levels are at an unacceptably high level, that at about, you know, close to 25% of children are overweight or obese in Australia.
Why do you think this issue is creating much concern?
The problem of childhood obesity has brought the issue of advertising of unhealthy foods to the attention of public health experts, the medical practitioners and parents, because it is a source of influence on children. And if we want to persuade children to eat more healthy foods, then we really need to address the counter forces that are persuading them to eat unhealthy foods. The other thing really is that marketing of unhealthy foods, which is my area, is growing at a rapid rate, so that, you know, where it started on television, it now extends to a whole lot of other media. So marketing is, you know, prolific on product packages that are directed at children for all sorts of products. You know, even eggs carry marketing to children now, or tuna, where once it just used to be sort of sweetened breakfast cereals and confectionery. Marketing also occurs on the internet through children's games and increasingly through social network sites that children access. Marketing is going to be coming through mobile phones, and children are getting access to mobile phones younger and younger. It occurs through children's magazines. So multiple media, really. It's not stopping in any way, even though many of the food and beverage companies, in particular the fast food restaurants, have supposedly signed up to responsible marketing to children. But really, the evidence shows that they may be decreasing their advertising on TV, but actually increasing their marketing on a whole other range of media.
Where do you see this issue heading?
What needs to happen is for there to be government-imposed restrictions on the marketing of unhealthy foods to children, simply because we've had many years of industry self-regulation, and we're really not seeing the industry cut back on its activities. And, you know, sort of common sense tells you it's very hard for business to do things that actually reduce their profits when their whole, you know, reason for being is to make profit. So, and children are a source of profit to these industries. I guess globally, the debate really, you know, is between whether self-regulation is going to work, and many of us feel it isn't, and whether governments need to step in.
Nutritionist and advertising analyst Kay Metta from Flinders University was speaking there to John Gibb for the Fourth Estate. A recent survey on the National Broadband Network, or NBN, was conducted among rural and regional Australia. It found that many people living in these areas are unprepared for the impact that a faster internet service will have, both on their business and everyday life. 1,040 people completed the survey conducted by Our Patch, and the results showed that while 65% believed the NBN will make a significant and positive difference on their life, 61% were unwilling to pay for it. Simon Van Wyk, director of Our Patch, thinks that this is because many people are still unsure of how the NBN will affect them. And Catherine Zangera began by asking why that is.
Well, I think part of the confusion comes because it's become so political, and we've got one side of politics telling us it's going to be fantastic and the other side of politics telling us it's not. And so I'm sure that's added to the confusion. But look, I think we've still got a very low number of Australian businesses actually using and connected to the internet. I think the number's about 30%. So, you know, a lot of people just haven't come to grips with the internet at all, and so the NBN coming along just adds to the confusion, particularly because it's such a noisy subject.
Mm. I guess if people are confused about getting on the internet in the first place, it's going to be really hard for them to understand what the NBN has to offer. But would people perhaps have been put off by that in the past because internet delivery has been so slow, and that's what they're hearing, is that, you know, it may be expensive or it may be, you know, very slow and therefore not very advantageous for you anyway?
Look, I think that's part of it, but also I'm not sure what internet connection you've got at home, but if you remember going from a dial-up connection to broadband and just how things changed when you did that, and people don't really understand that until they've done it. I mean, my in-laws had a dial-up connection at home, and we said, well, why don't you get a broadband connection? And they said, well, we're getting everything we need off the internet. And then you go, well, actually you're not. Wait until you connect it to broadband and then you'll understand what you really can get from the internet.
Mm. Oh, it makes a huge difference, doesn't it? But it's also made a huge difference for us as users of the internet, not just as businesses, because it means that those of us who have had access to faster broadband now expect things to happen really quickly. We want to click on things, we want them to play, we want to download things and have it happen quickly. And if businesses aren't up to scratch with delivering that sort of thing themselves, then it's going to put consumers off, isn't it? Because, you know, having faster broadband for those of us who do have it has really changed our expectations of how businesses perform.
Well, that's true. And also, look, when you've got broadband or an internet connection at home, a fast one, it actually becomes a utility. You know, you use it for a lot of things. You find recipes, you might book movie tickets, you look for restaurants, you read your newspapers. You just use it for a lot of things, and I think fundamentally that's the issue that small business in rural and regional Australia needs to understand, that as people come online, the internet actually becomes a tool that people use on a daily basis to do stuff. And if you're looking for a gardener, a plumber, a builder, an electrician, a restaurant, you'll go to the internet first instead of the yellow pages. I mean, Google said that they get 12,000 searches a day in Australia for the word builder. You actually need to make sure that someone can find you in your town or your suburb when they do a search for builder. And that's actually part of the challenge for small business as the NBN rolls out and people start using it more.
Mm. Why do you think regional and rural Australians aren't as ready to adopt the internet, and what a faster broadband supplied by the NBN could provide for them?
Oh, look, I think the thing that came out of our survey was that people, that users are definitely ready for it. Look, it's just been expensive and difficult. Yeah, rural and regional Australians tend to pay more for their internet connection. And when they pay for it, it's not quite as fast as the connections that we're all used to, city people are used to. So as it becomes easier to get broadband internet everywhere and it becomes cheaper, because hopefully it will, people will come online, and your habits change as you do come online with a broadband connection, and all of the things that we've seen in the city we'll see across rural and regional Australia.
Are people in rural and regional areas supportive of the idea of getting the NBN and faster internet delivery, even if they're not quite sure how to use it or what it means for them?
Well, there seems to be some confusion in that people are saying that they think faster broadband will be a good thing, but a lot of them are saying they're not necessarily prepared to pay for it. And then businesses, there's a little bit of confusion too, because people are saying, oh, well, they're not really sure if it means anything for their business, but they think they'll get better service from other business when the broadband internet is, when the NBN is here. But I think what we're going to see is opportunities out of rural and regional Australia when the NBN gets there, and broadband is easy, it's cheap, it's ubiquitous, people can connect their businesses up and and clever people will take advantage of those opportunities. And I think it'll be a boom for a lot of small Australian towns if they really want it to be.
Director of Our Patch, Simon Van Wyk, was speaking there with Catherine Zangara about their recent survey. Which sees us once again at the end of another half hour on the Fourth Estate. Thanks to the Humanities and Social Sciences Department at the University of Technology Sydney and Macquarie University's Faculty of Arts for their financial support. We'd love it if you checked out the website where you can find out how to download story files and even subscribe to the podcast. Just jump on your browser and hit in 4thestateradio.blogspot.com. Hope to catch you again next week. My name is Mick Caldwell.